genetic mechanism is quite similar to what is there in type 2 diabetes. So there is, it's a polygenic kind of inheritance. You can't pinpoint one gene, but definitely if a mother has PCOS, the daughter is more likely to have PCOS. And the, for the same reason, if the parents or one of the parents or both have type 2 diabetes, then the girl, the daughter is likely to have PCOS. That's like the similar situation like in type 2 diabetes. And girls who have PCOS are more likely to develop diabetes later in life.
Hello everyone, this is Vikas and you are listening to Run With Whitpage. Today is episode number 140. We are covering a topic that's relevant for several women runners, that is the condition of PCOS or PCOD, that is polycystic ovary syndrome or disease. As the name suggests, poly means multiple, cystic, that is cyst, multiple cysts, ovary, of course, you know of. And as Dr. Muthukrishnan in the conversation today will talk about that the name suggests the disease itself in many ways. Dr. Muthukrishnan has been on the podcast where we talked about type 2 diabetes. And today we are going to talk about another very important topic, that is PCOS or PCOD. You will see towards the end, we also covered a topic that has been discussed and drawn on from last week where with Dr. Adil, I was discussing the point of coronary arteries disease. The questions that came after the conversation, that was how to do cardiac evaluation correctly. That in some ways also is relevant for PCOS related cardiac evaluation. And he covers that topic as well. So that will be a brief bonus point for you. And I hope you enjoy it. If you see this is relevant for someone that you know, whether runner or a non-runner, I would suggest and request you that you share with that person as well, because you never know what could be very helpful for that person. That is just this piece of information that will help her take the very first step to diagnose and then eventually manage. Also, before we get into this very conversation, let's wish Mr. Kipchoge all the very best for this Sunday when he goes to Berlin and hopefully looks for another record in the marathon. If not a record, we will see and learn a lot from his experiences for sure. Let's wish him luck and get into this conversation with Dr. Brigadier Muthukrishnan. Let's go. Welcome back again. This second time we're discussing in the last 1 month. So this has to be very popular and you have to be a very popular speaker here on the podcast. Welcome on board. This is definitely going to be another very important topic that we'll be discussing today.
Yeah, thank you very much. I enjoyed it last time as well. Looking forward to this one as well.
Awesome. We've gone through your introduction and it's not needed again. So we'll get into the conversation right away. As we were discussing backstage, PCOS is the condition that we want to talk today. And endurance runners, they have been reaching out to us and they wanted for us to cover this topic. And so we thought this will be very relevant to discuss today. How about we start with why will it be relevant because of your experience? And then we'll get into what exactly is PCOS to start with.
Yeah, it's extremely relevant for the fact that most of the people who are running now are in the young and the middle age that we encounter. And as a disease condition, PCOS happens to be extremely common. And the fact that it is directly related to the same reason why people develop type 2 diabetes, and which is insulin resistance. All the factors that we discuss about why as Asians or as Indians, we are more prone to type 2 diabetes. For the same reason, we also are more prone to polycystic ovary syndrome or what is now called a polycystic ovarian disease. Because earlier it was a collection of symptoms and signs which was put together as a syndrome. But now we know that it's a disease entity. the basic underlying mechanism of its causation being insulin resistance.
Got it. And what exactly is this disease and why this happens?
As a disease, it's the name itself gives away part of the problem, which is actually just a finding on ultrasound, which is how people relate to it more often, actually, that there are multiple cysts in the ovary, which are seen on ultrasound in women. Now, the basic underlying mechanism being insulin resistance, what it entails is that there are there's a higher level of insulin in these individuals, purely because resistance, to overcome this resistance, body produces more insulin. This insulin is known to also act on ovaries directly and thus stimulate the ovaries and cause increased secretion of the male hormones, which is testosterone, in a female. The other problem that is there in these women is of anovulation, or what we call ovulation being the egg coming out of the follicles in the ovary during every cycle. And usually this would happen in the mid-cycle, that is between two menstrual periods for a lady. And when these eggs don't come out, are not able to come out of the follicle, they tend to remain there in the in a state where they appear as small swellings inside the ovary and what is known as small those cysts, which are visible on ultrasound. Now, this would lead to a state where if the egg doesn't come out, there is inability for the ovaries to produce adequate progesterone, which is the other hormone other than the estrogen. And that is what eventually leads to a state of having the next cycle. So this would lead to a delay in the next cycle, or maybe in some situations, cycles not happening at all, what we call as oligomenorrhea or amenorrhea. So there is anovulation or oligo-ovulation, that is less number of ovulation happening every month in the cycle. Thereafter, there is insulin resistance producing excessive male hormone in the female, which manifests in some of them, it manifests quite obviously as excessive facial hair, excessive body hair, which is in a distribution which is abnormal for a female, which and of also can lead to excessive acne or pimples, which are abnormal. So if you put all this together, you have a situation where there is oligo-ovulation or anovulation, leading to delayed menstrual cycles or absence of menstrual cycles. And on, in addition to that, there is excessive male hormone, which may or may not manifest clinically. One may be able to pick it up on blood tests, but in a lot of women, it would manifest as excessive body hair and acne. And the third component being what is seen on ultrasound as multiple cysts in the ovaries. Now, all these three manifestations put together was what was then called the polycystic ovary syndrome. And any two out of these three, if present in a woman, would be enough to label her to have PCOS. Now, like you rightly mentioned, it's a disease of exclusion, because there are certain other conditions which would produce the same problems, that is of ovulation not happening or excess male hormone being there in the female. And commonly these conditions are hypothyroidism, where the thyroid gland is not functioning adequately, or hyperprolactinemia, or pituitary glands producing excess of prolactin hormone, which also would lead to ovulation not happening. And also in patients who have a rarer condition, which is called Cushing's syndrome, where there is excessive steroid production in the adrenal glands, or even rarer condition, which is called late onset congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is extremely rare compared to all the other conditions that we discussed, but it also happens to be one of the conditions that we need to exclude before labeling a lady to be having PCOS. So overall, it's a complex syndrome.
Right. It seems
it's a disease
to be,
of diagnosis of exclusion,
diseases, you said,
but it's extremely common popular, like, because of the fact that very lifestyle to disorders be seen, have added to insulin amongst women, which seems, happens to be the underlying.
I don't know of exact numbers, but it seems like I've seen up to 10% of women of reproductive age are considered to be in this situation at some stage. I wanted to understand, is this something that happens over a period of time? Can you diagnose early? You talked about ultrasound, and will that be pelvic ultrasound that people need to undergo to figure that out more conclusively? Is there any preventive diagnosis that should be undertaken, or it's only symptom-based?
Yes, it is known to start right at the time when a girl would enter reproductive age group, which is around the age of 13, 14 years or slightly earlier than that. But what happens is that there is the initial 1 or 2 years when the periods or the menstrual cycles start in a girl, they are likely to be irregular, which is a normal occurring. So at that point in time, one does not diagnose PCOS, because that's one basic problem that is a part of the syndrome. But subsequent to that, if the girl continues to have ovulation, which is not happening adequately, if she is likely to have irregular cycles. And the fact that, if you see, that is the time when usually girls would be having lifestyle issues, considering the fact that they are at a stage in life when they are studying, they're not very physically active, most of the time is spent sitting, and most of them would actually gain weight during that period, because those are those crucial academic years. And we often see these girls coming to us at that point in time with these symptoms. Partly, some of them at least would be actually having PCOS, but there is a also a subset, which what we call as hypothalamic amenorrhea, which basically happens in girls at that point in time because of the various stressors which are related to exams, academics, career. So usually it settles down in the next few years, because any stress would lead to a problem in the hypothalamus and pituitary axis, which also leads to an ovulation, like it happens in PCOS. So we usually would like to ensure that those issues are sorted while we are going around diagnosing PCOS at that stage. But subsequent to that, at that young age, usually you would find initial presentation is often with irregular menstrual cycles. Thereafter, one may have associated symptoms of excessive male hormone in a girl, which is, like I mentioned, excessive body hair or acne. Sometimes these don't manifest, and we do a blood test for testosterone and find out the levels being high in the girl, which is also a part of the criteria to diagnose. The pelvic ultrasound that is done is the third part of the diagnosis, which may or may not always be present. You may not find polycystic ovaries in every girl who has PCOS. And also, in some situations, you may find polycystic ovaries on ultrasound, whereas the other two problems are not there. Even in that situation, that is not enough to diagnose this condition. But the fact that it is known by that name, generally in the lay public, that's a sort of a misconception that ultrasound finding, then they start sort of looking around for that diagnosis, which may not be true unless the other two aspects are also there. So that's how usually the girls would present at that age.
Sure. And is this something that the causes of this taking place, could it be genetic? Could it be something else? Or like, is it acquired, or it's progressive?
No, definitely there is an underlying genetic mechanism, and the genetic mechanism is quite similar to what is there in type 2 diabetes. Sure. So there is, it's a polygenic kind of inheritance. You can't pinpoint one gene, but definitely if a mother has PCOS, the daughter is more likely to have PCOS. For the same reason, if the parents or one of the parents or both have type 2 diabetes, then the girl, the daughter is likely to have PCOS. That's like the similar situation like in type 2 diabetes. And girls who have PCOS are more likely to develop diabetes later in life. So they both are quite closely connected. So there is a strong genetic background, but on top of that, like we always say in medicine, genetics loads the gun. It's the lifestyle or environment which pulls the trigger. Right. So usually you would find that this genetic susceptibility gets manifested because of the lifestyle issues, weight gain, excessive fat, leading to insulin resistance, and then these girls manifest with PCOS.
Right. It seems like my that is part of my question has been answered right here in pulling the trigger. That is, in case you know that your mother has had this situation, so that means that early lifestyle changes are the right way to go about maybe prolonging this situation or the onset of it, and that not occurring for as long as possible, isn't it?
Definitely. And in fact, one more thing that I need to add about PCOD is the fact that this is a lifelong condition, something similar to what is type 2 diabetes. Only thing is that the manifestations vary and the issues which require addressing vary as per the life stage of the girl. So if you start with, usually these girls would come with the problems of irregular menstrual cycles or excessive body hair or acne. They would subsequently, when they enter a stage where they got married and they are planning a pregnancy, because of the fact that ovulation is not occurring, then conceiving becomes a problem because pregnancy requires regular ovulation to occur, and that becomes a problem. So reduced in fertility is again a known problem in these women. And once they do get pregnant, subsequently, during pregnancy, the risk of developing diabetes, what is called gestational diabetes, or subsequently in life developing type 2 diabetes, also becomes more likely in these women. And usually after they have delivered, the subsequent part of their life or the middle age and beyond, all the factors which are complicated as part of type 2 diabetes also are part of the PCOS. So these women would be more likely to have type 2 diabetes and other vascular complications that happen in type 2 diabetes, like hypertension or coronary artery disease. So they are more prone to it later in life. Sure. So when we manage these women, we need to address the issues which are more likely to trouble them in that stage of life. But definitely, the background of insulin resistance, which is the underlying problem, needs to be addressed at every stage. So that's where the role of lifestyle management, exercise, diet plays the key role in managing PCOD.
Sure. So now that's where I wanted to move to is towards cardiovascular exercises or strength training or a combination of both. In managing the condition or delaying the process for the onset of these conditions in case parents have had this. So I wanted to understand from you, what would you suggest in case there is suspicion that this might occur over a period of time? Does exercise help in delaying this condition for it to occur? And if yes, what could be those exercises? Will it be cardiovascular exercises? Will it be strength training? Or what kind of protocol should be applied?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, if you see the exercise or diet, these two are the basic sort of part of the treatment when it comes to PCOD. All the drugs and subsequent rest of the treatment is, of course, there. But none of them works well if you not address the issue of insulin resistance. Which if you look at management of type 2 diabetes, this is somewhat similar. So both aerobic activities as well as strength improves insulin resistance by ensuring that there is reduction in adiposity as well as improvement in the glucose uptake by muscles, which happens by the endurance, the resistance exercises. Aerobic activities would also ensure that there is improvement in insulin sensitivity. And on top of that, there is definitely weight loss achieved, especially in women who are overweight or obese. When this is combined with a calorie deficit diet, or a diet where the carbohydrates are restricted, especially the simple carbohydrates. And any weight loss that is achieved in these girls would improve the insulin sensitivity. And it is known to improve the frequency of ovulation that happens. In even if there is no weight loss, there is improvement in insulin sensitivity, and which leads to improvement in ovulation and also brings down the levels of the male hormone that is testosterone. So diet and exercise definitely plays a huge role. And in girls who have an increased risk because of their parents being obese or mother having PCOD or having type 2 diabetes in the family, we definitely suggest that these girls should continue these kind of exercises right from the time when they are young, in fact, even before getting into the reproductive age group. And of course, the primordial prevention, that is, you may not have such a risk in the family, but nothing stops you from developing it subsequently in life, purely because as South Asians, we are more prone to it. We have those genes underlying. So we actually advise this to all the girls to follow so that these issues can be sort of prevented when they enter the reproductive age group.
Sure. So if someone is listening to this conversation and they think they may be at risk of acquiring this condition, from exercise point of view, and I wanted to split this into two parts, one exercise and second, I wanted to get into the nutrition a little bit in deeper details. From exercise point of view, what could be a couple of protocols that that should be taken? Will it be, when we say aerobic activities, will it be cycling, swimming, walking, running? And if that is the case, should it be similar to what we discussed in diabetes? That is like getting 150 minutes of aerobic activities and maybe 60 odd minutes for strength training. What would you suggest here?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, what you said about type 2 diabetes is exactly what are the recommendations for PCOS as well. But definitely there is a dose effect, and more is always welcome. In fact, because in younger individuals, this 30 minutes a day for 5 days or 150 minutes a week may not be adequate. In fact, in them, 45 minutes to 1 hour a day is what is recommended. And also a greater intensity of exercise is what is recommended when it comes to aerobics, with at least 2 days of strength training, which will help. Aerobic activity can be anything which one is comfortable with, but the idea is that the heart rate needs to go up for that duration that one is exercising, which is very important. So usually it has to be jogging, running or cycling, swimming, because these are things which, and just walking may not help as much as what people would think. A lot of people have this concept about doing yoga, which is definitely a wonderful way to actually have good health. But when it comes to PCOS, I think there are definitely, there is a role for doing something more intensive than yoga, which will help. But no exercise would help if there is not a careful look at what you're eating rest of the day. And so that's where there's a role of calorie restriction, especially in women who are overweight or obese. In that situation, one needs to ensure that there is a calorie deficit of at least around 500 calories to lose weight. And that also, one should avoid carbohydrates, especially the simple carbohydrates. Definitely avoid sugar, sweets, cola drinks, and these kind of things which are sort of give a spike to your sugar levels, which leads to increased insulin secretion, which is the basic underlying problem.
Right. On the exercise side, you talked about high intensity workouts. So will these be HIIT or some other? Because in younger days, you can take on some of these exercises and without having to worry too much about any of the other movement issues, etc. So will you suggest in addition to these being aerobic activities, which you can have steady state workouts, of course, either one introduces these various sprints, intervals, etc. within those workouts, or takes other HIIT activities, right?
No, it's, these HIIT activities have an advantage that you end up, especially in women who are not able to devote the kind of time that we are talking about exercising. These short duration but high intensity activities are known to have similar benefits as a longer duration of a more steady aerobic activity. So it's definitely something which can be recommended in girls who are able to do it, because not everyone is actually tuned to those level of intensity. So one need not sort of get into it and get injured, etc. But the idea is that regularity, consistency of what one can follow and for how long you can do it, like similar to what happens in diet, is what matters. So we advise these things. And of course, girls who are able to do it, I think HIIT has an important role in the fact that it can be equally effective even if you are doing it for a lesser amount of time.
Right. Okay. Moving to nutrition, which you already explained about, having caloric restrictive diet, being in caloric deficit is important. And there is a particular focus on low carbohydrate diet. I have also read that low carbohydrate diet is pretty important for, which seems pretty intuitive as well. But I'm also thinking that if it is a low carbohydrate diet, what should it be then more of? Will it be more of protein? Will it be more of protein and fat both? Where should someone be getting the daily energy from?
Yeah, the carbohydrates cannot be avoided in our diets. That's part of our social issue. So complex carbohydrates are still welcome because you cannot do without them. You would still have about 50% of calorie coming from carbohydrates. Otherwise, it happens to be around 60 to 70. But you can always compensate for that intake of, by increasing your protein intake. Because that's what will be also helpful when it comes to improving the your exercise intensity as well as your strength training, because the muscle repair would be better and also it would improve your insulin sensitivity. Along with that, to complete the calorie requirement, fats are not bad. The good fats are definitely welcome. But yes, checking on how much carbohydrates one is having remains the key when you have diet in PCOS or in type 2 diabetes.
Right. And for protein intake, like for us, what's been recommended, because we spend 5 to 6 days a week working out, we look at reaching up to 1.5 gram of protein per kilogram of body weight. In this condition, Is there any recommended per kilogram body weight wise protein requirement that's been suggested that seems to be optimal or not?
The basic definition of requirement remains same. It's around 1 gram per kg. But then it also depends on what kind of exercise one has gotten into. So one may have to increase this to 1.2 to 1.5 depending on how much exercise one is into and what is the intensity of that. But at least 1 gram per kg body weight protein intake has to be ensured.
Sure. And this question came from someone who's a runner and happens to have this condition. So the question from her was, it's slightly counterintuitive for her because being an endurance athlete, she has to have more of carbs and a lot of simple carbs during activities, especially the long runs and cycling that she's doing. How should she be looking at her carbohydrate intake in that case?
Yeah, I agree. One cannot do without these sort of gels or simple carbohydrates that we use normally. In athletes, one also needs to remember that sometimes we tend to overdo for the amount that's required compared to what we consume. So it also depends on what is the intensity that we are looking at when we are training or we are racing. And sort of ensure that we are not overdoing this intake of carbohydrates. It's not that we should totally avoid it, because it's very important to ensure that whatever activity you're doing, you're fueled adequately. So there's no harm in taking, but to avoid overdoing, if one can sort of, this has to be individualized. It's very difficult to define it for everyone, but one has to individualize and probably try with lesser amounts and see whether the performance is affected. In individuals who have some degree of sort of diabetes or pre-diabetes, it would be worthwhile to actually use the glucose sensors, especially if somebody who's a serious athlete. These glucose sensors would help there. You can see how much your glucose levels spike with your activity and the intake of simple carbohydrates that you're following, and then adjust your fueling accordingly. So in women who have these issues, I think the sensors would help ensuring that fueling can be individualized, so to speak.
Right. Okay. Most of our listeners are, they're also endurance athletes, and it could be that people who are listening, someone from there could be thinking that, yes, I know that I need to be working out, which I'm doing. I need to be following a particular nutrition, which I'm doing as well. The question could be that are there any type of exercises or workouts that one should be avoiding if there is a PCOS condition? That's one. And of course, again, this cannot be generalized, I understand, because it could also be that depends on what other condition exists along with PCOS. But I wanted to understand from you, if that is the case, are there some of the things that should be considered from exercise point of view or not?
This issue may not be so much in younger women, but definitely because of the vascular risk that happens in PCOS, similar to what happens in patients who have diabetes. So a woman who's beyond 35, 40, one should actually ensure that the cardiac evaluation is done, because they are at a higher risk than a woman who's not having this condition to develop a cardiac issue even before menopause has happened. So normally we consider that till menopause, women are fairly protected for their heart conditions. But when it comes to PCOS, this kind of protection is somehow not as good. And so these women also tend to develop pre-diabetes or diabetes, but they also tend to develop vascular complications of diabetes. So that's one. And two, hypertension is also more common in these women. So when they are getting into these kind of exercise activity, and especially if they are getting into it at a later stage in life and they've not done that earlier, then it's even so more important to undergo cardiac arrest. Something similar to what we advise men more often than women.
Right. And it may be a slight digress, and if that is, we can exclude that. But I was thinking, as we were discussing now, from a cardiac evaluation point of view, it seems quite subjective. I remember we did, just last week, we had done a podcast on coronary arteries disease condition and symptoms and the evolution of it, etc. And I've had tons of questions, people asking, what do you mean by cardiac evaluation? What are some of the things we should be doing when they go to the pathology? At times, they're suggested stress test. Someone says 2D echoes. Someone says it should be ECG, etc. And then there are some blood tests. I wanted to seek your guidance. If someone needs to look at their cardiac health and they need to evaluate themselves for vascular diseases and issues, what could be some of the evaluations that should be undertaken?
If you see if you are specifically asking for coronary artery disease, then the two important tests are ECG, which is a resting ECG, which is a routine done, and the stress ECG, which is a treadmill test. Now, but when we say cardiac evaluation, it also goes beyond coronary artery disease, and it includes the echocardiography. Basically because ECG and stress test would look at the electrical activity of the heart, it will also look at how the heart behaves while it is put under stress and electrically. So it would pick up any underlying coronary artery blockage, which may not be causing any problem during rest, but would cause a problem during stress. Echocardiography is important because it looks at the structure of the heart. So there are some issues which are structural, which may not be picked up on a routine ECG or even a treadmill test. But these are structural issues which can make an individual prone to have problems while he's exerting. Some of these are inborn, some of them can develop later in life. Basically, they can be valvular abnormalities, they can be abnormality of the cardiac muscle, which can be picked up on an echocardiography. So these, if you look at the basic test that one must undergo when we say cardiac evaluation, is a resting ECG. And if one is getting into a more intensive activity beyond 35, 40 years of age, then undergoing a stress test puts things at rest that, okay, your heart is able to take on that kind of activity, which you are trying to do now, whether running or swimming or those kind of activities. And echocardiography definitely at that stage, because you want to rule out certain conditions which may be underlying and not being picked up by any other methods. People are very fond of recommending CT angiography these days. So I'll clear that issue as well.
Cardiac CT.
Yeah, because cardiac CT angiography is basically a way of looking at the coronary arteries, which is short of doing a conventional angiography, where you inject a dye into the arteries and then look at how the blood is flowing through the coronaries, which is a more invasive thing. CT scan is slightly simpler that way.
And both of these are suggested, correct? What I've been reading from the literature, that seems people keep suggesting cardiac CT and the CTA both.
Yeah, so when we say angiography, sort of cardiac CT, it is basically along with angiography. Especially for this indication, it's a non-invasive way of looking at coronary arteries, whether there is a block. The problem with CT angiography is that it may not pick up some blocks, because that's why a conventional angiography is the gold standard. CT angiography may miss out on certain blocks. Secondly, CT scan involves radiation, and so that's the reason why, as a routine, it has not been in any guideline. You won't find, even sports medicine guidelines do not recommend you to undergo CT angiography to look for your coronary arteries. It's adequate to do a stress test and ECG to see whether your coronaries are functioning well. CT angio, if it shows a block, one cannot be still sure, and one has to then undergo a conventional angiogram to really exclude or diagnose or confirm that diagnosis. So eventually you end up doing both, which may not be required in most cases. So that's why CT angio is not routinely recommended for screening for this purpose. It has its own role for diagnosis, but not for an athlete getting into a sports activity.
Right. So if I understood correctly, basic cardiac profiling could be ECG at rest and stress test. These two will be the ones as a start point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Awesome. So from a PCOS point of view, we covered significantly in the onset of these, the evolution, the remission, as well as management of these, including exercise and training protocols. Do you think, from your experience, there anything that I might have missed to ask that you think is fairly relevant for people to listen to?
Yeah, if you're talking about women who are already diagnosed to have PCOS and are on treatment for it, then if they are getting into physical activity, one has to understand that the treatment for PCOS involves certain drugs, which for example, metformin, which is basically a drug used in diabetes, but it's also a drug recommended for PCOS, basically because it reduces insulin resistance. And that's how it works for PCOS. And it's a good drug. And most of the women in that age group would be on metformin when they are having PCOS. So that is okay. Does not hamper your exercise activity or diet, for that matter. But these women may also be on certain drugs which are hormonal, where it's a combination of estrogen and progesterone. So one has to ensure that there is adequate hydration when you exercise. Any level of estrogen or progesterone makes a person more prone to clotting of the blood. Although it doesn't happen, because the amount of estrogen progesterone in those drugs are very low, and they are fairly safe. But if somebody has a greater risk of these, genetic risk that is, of clotting, and there is always an increased risk of clotting when one is dehydrated because the blood gets thicker in that process. And we as athletes are more prone to it, getting dehydrated. So these women, if they are on these drugs, should ensure that they are adequately hydrated. And also some of these women may be on a drug called spironolactone, which is basically a drug which is given to PCOS patients. It works against the male hormone testosterone. But it's basically a diuretic, means it causes excessive urination, although it's not a strong diuretic, but it does affect the electrolyte levels to some extent. It may increase the potassium levels, reduce the sodium levels. So in such situations where you are on these drugs which are affecting your kidneys at some level, affecting your blood clotting at some level, and you are into a physical activity where there is a lack of hydration sometimes, there is a requirement of a proper renal functions, electrolyte levels. So one has to ensure that you are taking care of all those aspects while you are on these drugs. So I think that's something that I may add to in this topic when we are discussing PCOS.
Sure. And when we talk about hydration, it's not only water, it's also electrolytes that are extremely important.
Yes, definitely.
Right. Awesome. Thank you so much. This was very helpful and brief and to the point. Thank you so much for joining today. We are very grateful for you being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was all for today. I think this was of great value. Short, brief, to the point. That made sense, isn't it? Keep enjoying, keep listening, and give us feedback of how we are doing. And we promise you, we will keep improving if there is any feedback that you want us to focus on. Good luck, and I'll speak with you guys next week again. Bye.